The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I'll read part one of a novella published in the April 27th, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Bicycle Accident by Joyce Carol Oates. Evie's accident with the bike, they would call it, or, if a reproach was intended, a hint that Evie had no one but herself to blame for almost getting killed on the Cayuga Bridge and the summer of misery that followed. Evie's accident with her bike. Was it a subtle distinction? The bike, her bike? Arlette, Evie's mother, took care never to allude to the accident on the bridge in the second way. She never blamed Evie. She was so grateful that her daughter was alive. To think that you almost died, Evie, on that bridge, and we didn't even know where the hell you were. How could you sneak away like that without telling me? That had been the hurtful thing. Without telling me. But she didn't know Evie to know that. She wasn't that kind of mother. Early that morning, Arlette had enlisted Evie to help her prepare food for an outdoor reception that she was hosting to celebrate Anissa's engagement, mother and daughter working as a team in the kitchen. In the backyard, the boys helping their father to set up rental tents, tables, and folding chairs. 48 guests. For weeks, Arlette had been anticipating this day. On the kitchen wall calendar, June 23rd was circled in red marker like an exploding nebula. And now rain was forecast for late afternoon. They would be huddling beneath dripping tents instead of spreading out all over the lawn, where banks of bridal wreath and crimson peonies were blossoming. It had been a season of squalls and rainstorms. Mid-morning, the sky was pale and featureless, no rain clouds in sight. But in Strikersville, storm clouds could take shape within minutes. Thunder in the distance like a sound of rolling barrels, lightning, walls of quick pelting rain. Then, within an hour, rays of sun breaking through the darkened sky, as if it were the most natural thing in the world. Since she'd first set the date for her niece's reception, Arlette had had difficulty sleeping. Frequently, she woke from dreams of food, guests, weather. Kevin laughed at her. She'd become so fixated on food. Appetizers, entrees, desserts were roiling fevers in her blood. A summer buffet meant cold things, platters of sliced turkey breast, Virginia ham, roast beef, German potato salad, coleslaw, sweet corn, deviled eggs, tomatoes, a green salad of romaine lettuce, Boston lettuce, fresh basil. Everything freshly prepared. Nothing acquired ready-made from a food store or the farmer's market. The sourdough bread Arlette would bake that very morning. Anyone who entered the house would be met with the mouth-watering aroma. A fruit platter, artfully arranged, pineapple chunks, melon balls, pitted black cherries, strawberries, blueberries, raspberries, banana cream pie, angel food cake with chocolate chiffon frosting, several flavors of ice cream. Kevin had agreed to let her well-to-do older friend, Rob Nash, provide the more costly drinks, wine, whiskey, vodka, gin. Cassie, the niece, was deeply moved that Arlette was hosting the party for her and her fiancé, though she said weakly, you don't need to do this for us, Aunt Arlette. A catered reception would be so much easier. No fuss.
It wasn't fuss, Arlette protested, hurt.
Cassie's mother had passed away 3 years before, and it seemed to Arlette the least she could do for her sister. Kevin thought that a caterer was pretentious. Nothing got Kevin as riled up as people putting on airs. He took pride in their three-acre property at the edge of Strikersville. Bi-level ranch, white aluminum siding, shingled roof. Mowed the lawn himself on a tractor mower. With a chainsaw, he kept the trees and shrubs on the property trimmed. From the redwood deck, built with the help of a carpenter friend, You had a scenic view of farmland, the rolling foothills of the Chautauqua Mountains. Kevin was part owner of Ace Hardware at the mall, shaking hands with customers 6 days a week, convivial, good-hearted, nothing pretentious about Kevin Hansen. In the backyard, he ordered the boys around in his funny daddy voice. "A whistle while you work, guys!" In the kitchen, Arlette put Evie in charge of the deviled eggs. Time-consuming and not so easy. Why her mother couldn't just buy deviled eggs at the Safeway, Evie had no idea. All this work to prove what? To save money? Evie was 13 years old, no longer a young child flattered when Arlette cooed, "Mommy's little helper," at her. No longer grateful for her mother's praise. She resented being woken so early on a Saturday, and she resented her brothers outside with their father, laughing and shouting. With Daddy, there was always some kind of horsing around, as Arlette called it. With Mom, there was nothing like that. No laughing, no fun. You had to take care not to seem mouthy. By late morning, Evie had begun to grow fatigued. Restless, tired of working at the formica-topped counter beside Arlette, who was edgy and irritable. Evie begged to be allowed to ride her bicycle to the end of the cul-de-sac and back. Just 5 minutes. "Oh, not right now. No, we don't have time to waste." Roy and Billy got to go with Daddy to the mall to pick up supplies. They were away 40 minutes at least, stopping at the Dairy Queen for cones on the way back. Evie just knew. Her father liked to pretend that Evie was Daddy's little girl, but really, he preferred her brothers, who were 11 and 8. The way he played with them, rough and growling with laughter, was nothing like the way he'd played with Evie, treating her like a doll that might break in his hands. It was unfair. Evie was captive in the kitchen, preparing 3 dozen deviled eggs, which had to be done in stages, a dozen eggs at a time, bringing them to a slow boil in a pan, making sure that they didn't crack, cooling them in cold water in the sink, removing the shells required precision and patience, which Evie didn't have. So the task took twice as long and was messy. Bits of eggshell stuck to the rubbery egg whites, and Evie had to pick them off one by one with her nails. And that was just the preliminary step. Now came carefully scooping out the hard-boiled yolks, mashing them in a bowl with a fork, mixing in mayonnaise, lemon juice, vinegar, paprika, red pepper, salt. Then spooning the mixture back into the egg whites, taking care not to ruin them. At the Safeway, you could purchase deviled eggs on a large plastic circular platter with shallow indentations for the eggs so that they wouldn't slip and slide onto the floor. "Evie, pay attention! We don't have time to waste. It's almost noon." Evie lifted a plate precipitously and 2 eggs slithered to the floor. "Oh, damn!" Half sobbing under her breath, but of course Arlette heard. "Watch your mouth, young lady. Finish up those eggs and put them in the refrigerator with wax paper over them." The things you hear yourself uttering. "Watch your mouth, young lady," and your daughter staring at you like she hates you. Problem was, her role in all this was mother. Someone had to be the mother, and Arlette was it. Kevin was one of those exasperating fathers. If the kids were dogs, he was the parent to let them run off leash, secure in the knowledge that the mother would discipline them and keep them not only alive but presentable before the sharply assessing eyes of others. Others, meaning family, in-laws, relatives, neighbors, friends, and acquaintances with whom you'd gone to school, whose scrutiny you could not ever elude. "Excuse me, Arlette, honey, do you mind?" Rob Nash entered the kitchen, needing to use the bathroom in the hall. Any space that Rob Nash entered, he took up all the oxygen. Big, ruddy face, beaming smile, faded Rolling Stones t-shirt strained tight over his torso, which was as round as a drum. A wink for Arlette, whom he'd favored since she was a sweet, pretty girl, and a waggish thumbs-up for 13-year-old Evie, plain, pale face, hips as narrow as a boy's.
Rob Nash had arrived in his Land Rover mid-morning to help Kevin and the boys set up for the reception. Arlette had been hearing his braying laughter out back. You couldn't help but smile when Rob Nash was on the premises. He was a great joker, a teller of tales, brazen in his exaggerations. True, he was bossy, but funny bossy. Rob was one to make much of you if he singled you out for attention. Arlette had a suspicion that Rob had talked Kevin into allowing him to provide not only drinks for the reception, but the rented tents, tables, and chairs. If not, Rob had surely arranged for Kevin to rent the equipment at a discount. Rob Nash liked to boast that he knew everyone in Strikersville. When it came to favors, he was the most owed. Often, Rob joked mysteriously, laying a forefinger beside his nose, which was broad and flattened, as if the cartilage had been broken and had only partly healed. His cheeks were stippled with broken capillaries. You were made to think that you were in on the joke while others were excluded, but, in fact, you weren't really in on the joke, had no idea what the joke was. But Rob Nash was inviting you to pretend that you did because he liked you, because you were a favorite of his. Rob Nash's inner circle. Rob Nash had been Arlette's father's friend initially, a lawyer, businessman, philanthropist. Not that philanthropist was a word casually employed. Generous, gives away money were the more likely terms. At one time, he'd been an amateur actor, the high point of his acting career being the role of the stage manager in Thornton Wilder's Our Town when Arlette was in middle school. She recalled seeing him moving about the stage in the spotlight. Not a handsome man, not a handsome exactly, but with the assurance of one. He'd had hair then, thick, tufted, leonine hair going gray at the temples. Now his body had thickened. He wasn't as tall as he'd once been. He dressed to catch the eye, plaid blazers, floral neckties, seersucker suits in the summer. He had a habit of sagely stroking his chin as if there were a beard there. His speech was liberally sprinkled with profanities and obscenities when he was in the company of men. Arlette knew this, but in the company of women, he took care to speak courteously. He'd been married twice, divorced twice. Arlette had a vague memory of the wives, both pale blonde women, stylish, no children. Often, Rob expressed disappointment over this. Life disappointed him. Women disappointed him. But he didn't dwell upon the past. He was a progressive, or what you'd call a progressive conservative. It was generally known that Rob Nash had drawn up his will more than once. He'd disinherited relatives who had disappointed him. Kevin knew. You took great care with what you said to Rob Nash, even when he seemed to be inviting frank talk, intimate exchanges. Rob frequently hinted that Kevin, Arlette and their children would be remembered in his will. It was said of Rob that he was a devoted friend, but he could be an even more devoted enemy. You did not ever want to cross Rob Nash. Arlette thought this was unfair. All sorts of nonsense was said about prominent personalities in Strikersville. She'd never had the slightest feeling of unease around Rob. He was like an uncle to her. She'd basked in his attention as a girl. He'd given her gifts, cashmere sweater sets, charm bracelets, a $100 gift certificate for Strikerville's leading clothing store for women. Rob had lent Kevin money for a down payment on his Ford Ranger pickup, and he'd helped out with the Hansons' property taxes from time to time. How much he'd invested in Ace Hardware, Arlette didn't know, but he'd certainly invested something. Couldn't ask Kevin. That would provoke a line between Kevin's eyebrows as sharp as the mark of a knife blade in bread dough. Rob Nash lingered in the kitchen, talking and laughing with Arlette as she prepared potato salad. Rob was a shameless gossip, offering tidbits of information about mutual acquaintances, to which Arlette would respond, drawing in her breath, "Oh, Rob, that is not true." Rob had been drinking ale in the backyard. he and Kevin both. The men were most at ease with each other when they were drinking. Rob's face was looking windburned, pleasantly flushed. The faded Rolling Stones t-shirt had risen up, bearing a patch of waxy white slack midriff. At the other end of the counter, Evie was hoping that her mother's talkative friend wouldn't take notice of her. If Rob Nash addressed her at all, it would be in a teasing way, which she dreaded. She'd been urged to call this friend of her parents Uncle Rob, but never had. Once she had overheard a conversation between Rob Nash and her parents outside on the deck. Heard Rob Nash boasting that he planned to help out with her college tuition someday, for instance, if she wanted to attend a private university like Syracuse or Cornell. "You both know you can count on me, right?" Now Evie watched in disgust as her mother lifted a spoonful of potato salad to Rob Nash's gaping mouth. Was her mother flirting with him? "Fantastic, Arlette," and Rob smacked his lips. Evie looked away, shuddering. As if Rob Nash had been reading her mind, there he stood, looming above her and laughing at her discomfort. Inspecting the platter of deviled eggs, Evie dreaded him scooping up an entire egg and devouring it, but instead, as if more intimately, Rob rubbed his forefinger in a circle inside the bowl that Evie had used to prepare the mixture, tasting it and declaring it delicious. "Arlette, you've got a terrific little helper here." Evie was vastly relieved when Rob Nash left the kitchen. But within a few minutes, he came back to the door, bringing his large face close to the screen, startling both Evie and Arlette with his ebullient voice. "Hey, sorry to interrupt again. Arlette, your husband is sending me for ice. He's freaking out that the 7-Eleven will run out if we wait much longer. Evie, you coming with me?" Quickly, Evie shook her head. She wasn't comfortable around adults, even adults of whom she was fond. They talked at you nonstop as if you were slow-witted. "Yes, go with Rob. You can help him with the ice. Keep him company. You've been whining to have a break. Go on." Arlette spoke pleasantly, not at all bossy. Evie laughed uneasily, muttering, "Guess not." "Don't be ridiculous, Evie. Go with Uncle Rob. He's been working hard helping your father out there in the sun." Briskly, she added, "I'll finish up here. You've left quite a mess. Go on with Rob and be useful for a change." Grinning, Rob Nash was holding the screen door open. Evie had no choice but to slip through. It gave her a shivery sensation to feel the top of her head, her hair, lightly brush against his brawny arm. So Evie rode off with Rob Nash and his sporty Land Rover to the 7-Eleven in town. They would be gone nearly an hour, but Arlette took little notice since she was on the phone with Cassie. Not an urgent call, but a time-consuming one. Shortly after that, the phone rang again, and it was a friend explaining why she couldn't come to the party. Sorry for the last-minute notice. Arlette felt her heart pound with dread. What if more guests canceled? Didn't show up? She had made herself so vulnerable. By this time, Kevin had succeeded in erecting the party tent. The backyard was looking cluttered, but festive. Arlette was feeling encouraged. Most of the food preparation was done. The refrigerator was crammed. Time for the hostess to hurry upstairs and shower. Change into a halter-top summer dress, white cotton percale with splotches of red poppies, belted waist. Blow-dry her dark brown hair, which felt like a luxury to her, sensuous, as comforting as a caress. Frowning into the mirror as she rubbed moisturizer into her skin. No mascara to highlight her eyes, not in the daylight, but red lipstick to give life to her mouth. When Arlette returned to the kitchen, she saw the Land Rover rolling into the driveway. There was Rob Nash unloading two massive bags of ice cubes from the rear of the vehicle. One of these he left outside with Kevin, and the other he brought, slung over his shoulder, into the kitchen to shove into the freezer. Struggling behind Rob Nash was Evie, both arms crossed against her chest, carrying a grocery bag with bottles rattling inside.
tonic water, seltzer, a six-pack of Coke. These were purchases that Rob Nash had made on the spur of the moment, just so you don't run out. Now, better too much than too little, right? Rob, thanks. What do we owe you for this? Arlette felt she had to ask out of politeness. Rob Nash laughed, dismissing her question with an airy wave of his hand. It's on the house, of course. It's on Uncle Rob. He was going home now to spruce up, he said. He'd be back soon for the event. Hard to be a bachelor living alone in Strikersville, Arlette thought, with a twinge of sympathy. Such a family kind of town. Arlette had the uneasy idea that Rob intended to give Cassie and her fiancé some sort of engagement present, possibly a check, and if a check, a large check. No one else would have presents for the couple, not for an engagement. Rob Nash always had to amplify things. That was his way. There stood Evie with the grocery bag still clasped across her flat chest. Her hair was disheveled, her pale blue eyes puffy damp, narrowed. Arlette told her to put the bag down. Go upstairs, take a shower, put on something nice for a change. Not those same old denim shorts. And be sure to shampoo your hair and use conditioner so it won't frizz like dandelion fuzz. And don't take forever. We're running late. Evie let the bag fall rattling onto the kitchen counter, stony-faced, pushing past her mother without a word. Arlette felt a stab of dismay. Never would she have confessed to anyone, certainly not to Kevin, that she envied her friends whose daughters were attractive, charming, fun to be around, at least two of them startlingly beautiful at Evie's age. It was a damned hard world for a girl who wasn't attractive, regardless what people said. Feminist meant to be optimistic, encouraging. Of course it would help that Evie was bright, but the fact was that no one would glance twice at her if there were other girls in the vicinity. Arlette located the boys, herded them upstairs to see that their hands were properly washed, get them into clean clothes. Billy, with a dirty face, looking like a ferret. Roy was old enough to take care of himself, but couldn't be trusted to. It was never finished, taking care of children. The infinity of details. Back downstairs, Arlette greeted the first guests, cousins who'd volunteered to help with the reception. You're looking terrific, Arlette. Well, you're looking terrific. Damn! The phone again. Arlette drew a deep breath, steeled herself for another apology, but it was just one of Kevin's annoying relatives confirming what time the reception began. Cassie arrived with the fiancé. Nervous laughter, hearty handshakes. The fiancé was taller than Arlette remembered, better looking. Cassie had done something with her hair, a kind of weird pink rinse that wasn't becoming. Arlette felt a rush of emotion. Engagement, wedding, marriage, love. All this behind her now. Just slightly spoiled, like a container of milk in the refrigerator beginning to sour. Still, you are grateful. Arlette was. Other relatives arrived. As if a dam had burst, a sudden rush of people. Was it going to rain? Thunder? Lightning? What if there wasn't enough food? Enough to drink? Rob Nash would help in an emergency. Arlette could rely upon him to drive her into town to the store. Thank God Kevin was herding people out of the crowded kitchen onto the deck. Outside, loud music. Kevin's speakers on the terrace. Tuned to a local rock station, which wouldn't have been Arlette's choice. In her sandals with a medium heel, Arlette was stumbling, carrying platters outside. Stylish shoes. Sexy, not practical. She had wanted to show off her shapely legs, almost slender ankles. She recalled how, when she was pregnant, each time her ankles had swollen, also her face. With his stiff, vacant smile, Kevin had managed to avoid looking at her, touching her. In a while, she'd kicked off the shoes. After a drink or two, why not? Barefoot. That was sexy, too.
She wasn't yet 40 years old. Her toenails were polished bright red. Bowls of nuts, fresh-cut vegetables, creamy dill chip, Evie's deviled eggs quivering on a platter. In a snug-fitting blue-striped seersucker jacket and white cord trousers, Rob Nashery appeared, rubbing his hands together in anticipation. "The party's like a stream," Arlette was remembering. "You're anxious at the start, but soon the current carries you away, and you begin to relax, and you have a drink. White wine with an Italian label provided by Rob Nash. Then you have a second drink, and soon you are laughing with the others. Even with an overcast sky, the ominous rumbling of thunder in the distance. It might have been half an hour, 40 minutes. Someone called to Arlette from the kitchen. There was a phone call. Oh, hell, who is it? Arlette hurried into the house, blindly seized the receiver. Yes, this is the Hansen residence. Who is this? In this way, so abruptly, their lives were cut in two, as if with a meat cleaver. A buzzing in the mother's ears as she hears herself asking in disbelief, "What? What are you saying? What?" Evie wasn't upstairs, and Evie wasn't in the backyard. Evie was at the ER at the Strikerville General Hospital. She'd had an accident riding her bicycle across the Cayuga Bridge, 2 miles from home. Witnesses reported that the 13-year-old had been pedaling her bicycle rapidly, recklessly, on the pedestrian walkway where warning signs were prominently posted. Bicycles must be walked, not ridden, across the bridge. The Cayuga Bridge was a 2-lane iron girder bridge of another era. Vans and SUVs had to maneuver carefully to pass one another on it. Larger vehicles were banned altogether. The ramp leading up from the road was steep, and the floor of the bridge was open mesh grating. If you looked down through the grating, you could see the river moving swiftly beneath in a way that dazzled the eye and benumbed the brain. Halfway across the bridge, Evie had to swerve to avoid colliding with a pedestrian, a young mother pushing a toddler in a stroller. There were screams from both the young mother and the cyclist, whose sneakered foot slipped from the pedal of the bicycle in such a way that her bare leg was dragged down below, trapped between the underside of the pedal and the open mesh grating, against which her knee and leg were being scraped raw as the bicycle hurtled inexorably forward. Head first, she was pitched over the handlebars, and she fell, her right leg still entangled with the bicycle, exposing tendons, ghastly white bone amid a gushing of blood. In the adjacent lane, vehicles were braking, sounding their horns, for it looked as though the young bicyclist might tumble into the lane of traffic. There was a 3-inch gash in her scalp. It would be discovered that her skull was fractured. Her upper front teeth had been knocked from her ravaged gums. Her right leg was not only lacerated but broken. Her knee shattered. The sneaker had been wrenched from her right foot, white cotton sock torn and bloodied. In the ambulance, the stricken girl was unable to speak, to identify herself. Her mouth filled with blood from the broken teeth and had to be suctioned repeatedly. She passed in and out of consciousness, the way a creature running for its life passes in and out of splotches of sunshine and cloud shadows. An oxygen mask was pressed over her mouth and nose, alternating with the suction device. Medical workers could discover no ID in the pockets of the girl's torn clothing. They believed that they might lose their patient before they arrived at the ER on West Avenue. But somehow that did not happen. Her young heart faltered but rallied, continued to beat. And after 40 minutes in the ER, the patient appeared to be stabilized. In faint voice, she provided her name and address. Eve Ann Hansen, 1664 Post Road. A call was made to the Hansen residence. Both parents came to the hospital where their daughter was undergoing an fMRI scan, following which emergency surgery to reduce the swelling in her brain. Later, the parents would recall their vigil at the hospital, which extended well into the next day. Dazed, disbelieving that their daughter hadn't been safely at home, as they'd assumed, or would have assumed if they'd thought about her, but miles away, fighting for her life. The particular shock of such a revelation, amid the festivity of a backyard party. "What? What are you saying? What?" These words echoing in Arlette's head for days afterward. Weeks, months, and eventually years. Forgotten as if it had never been, the reception for Cassie and her fiancé. An event obsessively planned for weeks, deleted from consciousness as abruptly as a light switched off. So abruptly that the Hansons had left their guests back at the house. Only a few, who happened to be in the kitchen at the time of the call, knew where they'd gone. When Rob Nash heard the news, as incomplete as it was, like a ship's captain, he calmly assumed responsibility for the situation, briskly informing the guests that there had been a family emergency. Evie had had a bicycle accident, and suggesting that they go home and refrain from calling the Hansons until maybe the next morning. Rob Nash in charge, not jovial, but stark cold sober, as he was rarely seen. Now that his broad smile had faded, the laugh lines at the corners of his eyes looked like minute white stitches in the skin. Arlette's parents were at the reception. They would take care of Roy and Billy. At the hospital, Arlette and Kevin were telling themselves, "All that matters is that our daughter is alive." Hesitant to ask the doctors if there would be a full recovery, better not to ask, just yet. "Some sort of bicycle accident," Rob Nash would say, shrug of his shoulders, a gesture signaling that whatever it was that had happened on the Cayuga Bridge, precipitated by the daughter, it was essentially a small matter, foolish, juvenile. Soon to become one of Rob Nash's tales told about town. For Rob Nash was something of a first-hand witness, the Hansons' closest family friend. In the telling, Rob would not speak of Evie by name. He gave the impression of not knowing her name. Kids riding their bicycles in traffic, not watching where they're going. Over the Cayuga Bridge. Supposed to get off and walk their bikes over the bridge, but they don't. That age, they think they'll live forever. But you run over one of them, and you'll be the one that's arrested. Spend the rest of your life in prison. Well, maybe not in prison, but feeling guilty for sure. Rob Nash, flushed with drink, intoning with a grave shake of his head as if passing judgment on an entire generation. "I wouldn't think a bike accident, a kid on a bike, could be so serious, ruin everybody's life. But of course they're not wearing a safety hat, helmet, whatever you call it." Which she was not, that girl, Kevin Hansen's girl. Whose fault is that? For 18 days, Evie was a patient at the Strikersville Hospital. These were bleary, blurry days of which she would have little recollection afterward. Initially in the intensive care unit, then the general hospital, and from there to the rehab clinic, where she was first an inpatient wincing in pain when the opioid haze protecting her wore thin, then an outpatient, wheelchair, crutches, walker, finally a single crutch, driven to the clinic, usually by her mother, through the remainder of that interminable summer and well into the fall, when everyone of school age had returned to normal life. When not at the rehab clinic, she was at a dental clinic in Rochester, 60 miles away, undergoing surgery to repair her injured mouth and, in time, being fitted for a partial plate to replace the 5 upper front teeth that had been literally knocked from her mouth. "Smile, Evan! Wide smile! Smile like you mean it!" The jolly, portly dentist encouraged his patient so forcefully that Arlette found herself grinning a wide clown smile in her daughter's place. At home, a rented hospital bed had been brought into the TV room, which became Evie's quarters for the next several months. Those months, a succession of doctor's appointments, blood tests, x-rays and CT scans, fMRIs monitoring the damage to the part of her brain known as the frontal lobe, where the skull fracture had been most severe. In her weakened state, Evie was susceptible to infections, sudden fevers. Often she was prescribed antibiotics, medication for pain, for sleep, medication to counter the gastric distress caused by the other medications. For weeks, Evie was almost wholly dependent upon her mother, could not make her way to the bathroom unassisted, could not prepare her own food, deal with such practicalities as bathing herself, shampooing her hair, soiled the bedclothes two or even three times a week. She woke in the night not knowing where the hell she was. Night itself confused with day, amid the opioid numbness that was like cotton batting, through which flashes of pain penetrated, flashes that left her gasping in pure, visceral shock. They could come at any time. She could never predict. "Mom! Mom!" she heard herself crying, calling like a helpless child. For indeed she was a helpless child. Arlette came at once, even in the night, hastily, anxiously. There was a kind of power in this, that Evie could summon her mother by raising her voice. Evie could disturb the entire household if she called out loudly enough, in a voice tremulous with terror. When Arlette asked Evie why she was so frightened when she was safe here at her home, Evie answered in a hushed voice, "But I'm not safe here. I'm not safe anywhere. They didn't tell you I died in the ambulance. They were afraid of being sued, probably. I saw my actual soul, like smoke. It came out of my mouth just like smoke. I am not attached to my earthly body. You should know, Mom. You were there." So calmly Evie spoke, Arlette was stunned, perplexed. She would never repeat Evie's bizarre words. She would soon forget Evie's bizarre words. The days of Evie's convalescence were less fearful than the nights, but still she felt displaced, obscurely cheated, in the TV room where the furniture had been rearranged, the sofa pushed against a wall. Annoyed when her brothers wanted to watch their stupid TV programs, but lonely when she was by herself. She could hear others elsewhere in the house, oblivious of her. There were friends, girls in her grade at school, who wanted to visit. But Evie shook her head. "No!" Rob Nash came to see the bedridden girl, bringing a bouquet of flowers for Arlette and a box of Godiva chocolates for Evie. But Evie refused to see him. Arlette had no choice but to send Rob away, abashed, furious, protesting to Evie that she was being rude. "You know your Uncle Rob is concerned for you." "Is he?" Evie's eyelids were half shut. She refused to look at Arlette. "Evie, what is wrong with you?" Evie laughed, muttering something inaudible. "What? What did you say?" Evie shook her head, pushed away the gaudy Godiva box, winced as if her head ached. Since the accident, she'd become hypersensitive to light. A migraine headache could come over her like a suddenly overcast sky. Quickly, Arlette had to lower the shades, or Evie would begin to scream at her. Wondering uneasily what would happen if Rob Nash became disenchanted with the Hansen family, what losses they would all suffer, of which they might not even be aware. Through the autumn, Arlette was the liaison between Evie and school, bringing Evie's homework assignments to her homeroom teacher, Mrs. DeLuca, and returning the graded pages. Evie hated how her homework took twice as long as in the past. Her vision swam, her eyes ached. She much preferred drawing in a sketchbook that Arlette had bought for her, with a fancy marble swirl cover in dark reds, suggesting the interior of a body. Evie overheard Arlette speaking on the phone in the kitchen to a friend or relative, declaring that she'd always wanted to be a nurse when she was a girl, and now she was her daughter's nurse, and loving it.
Evie could detect no irony, no suggestion of complaint, rather a bright, buoyant boastfulness in her mother's voice. "Yes, Evie is expected to recover fully," Arlette said often, as if dispelling doubt at the other end of the telephone, "and return to school in a month or two. Hey, it isn't easy. Rehab, physical therapy. It hurts, I know." Unable to bear it, Evie shouted at her mother, "No, you don't know. I hurt." Still, daughter and mother were becoming very close. Wet, dreary, leaf-strewn autumn days alone in the house together. When Evie finished her homework, Arlette allowed her to watch TV in the afternoon. Might even join Evie for a while before the boys returned home and the TV was hastily turned off. Roy and Billy had become shy with their sister, who seemed to like them less than she had before the accident. Though, once she'd been protected of them, now she was impatient, sarcastic. Roy resented the adult attention deflected onto Evie, saying to Evie in an undertone so that their mother couldn't hear, "I bet you could walk if you wanted to." Evie responded coldly, words of a kind that she had never before uttered in his hearing. "You ugly little rat. Die." Roy was shocked. At 11, he said things that he didn't mean, that flew into his head that no one took seriously. Evie had retaliated as another 11-year boy might have. He wasn't prepared for such a response. Eventually, with Arlette's assistance, Evie made her way into the sunroom at the side of the house, which was glassed in and heated. This attractive room Kevin had added to the house with the assistance of his carpenter friend. Propped up against pillows on a rattan sofa, Evie drew in her sketchbook for long hours, drowsy from medications. If she lifted her eyes, she had a view of skeletal trees, open fields, and in the distance the foothills of the Chautauqua Mountains. She and Arlette worked on jigsaw puzzles set on a low table beside the sofa. These were large, intricate puzzles depicting American landscapes painted by 19th century artists Frederick Church, Albert Bierstadt, Thomas Cole. Dreamlike vistas, rivers, skies that could take many hours to complete. Out of mischief, unless it was pure meanness, Hivvy hid away crucial pieces so that Arlette searched in vain for them. "Oh, Christ, where is it?" During these long, quiet hours when the boys were at school and Kevin was at the mall, Arlette confided in Evie as she would not have otherwise, telling her how, when she was Evie's age, she was not happy with herself. "There was this game I played in secret. Whoever was the next person I saw, whoever came around a corner, I could change places with them. This was like a wish I could make." Evie was perplexed, disapproving. "You mean you'd rather have been any old person instead of yourself? A homeless person? Someone in a wheelchair? Someone with cystic fibrosis?" "Well, it was childish. I was a child. I didn't think I was pretty or that anyone would like me." "What you were was spoiled, ignorant, trading places with just anyone?" "All right, Evie, you've made your point." Whoever Evie had been before the accident, however annoying at times, this judgmental young person was quite different. No longer a child, yet not mature. Her face in repose was peevish, petulant. Her skin was sallow, her eyes without luster. Hair had grown back thinly over the jagged scar in her skull. Evie fretted that it would never grow back entirely. Other kids would notice and jeer at her. She'd have to wear a cap indoors. 3 times a week, Arlette took Evie to the rehab clinic. The change in her daughter there was amazing to Arlette. She tried not to be jealous of the physical therapist, whom Evie clearly admired, respected. No slouching at rehab, no muttered asides or sighs. Evie obeyed this young woman's instructions that she would never have obeyed her mother's. She was willing to undergo pain for the therapist, to wince with pain, tears running down her cheeks, staggering to get her balance. At which the therapist paused to commend her,
to praise her, touching her lightly on the shoulder. "Good, Evie. Now let's try it again." Arlette looked through Evie's sketchbook, surprising to her that her daughter seemed to have some genuine talent for drawing. If she concentrated too hard, the drawings were stiff, but if she worked swiftly, almost carelessly, they were lifelike, inspired. "Sweetie, what's this?" A wrecked bicycle that seemed to be also a twisted, deformed, scrawny girl figure with a toothless mouth distended in a silent scream. A flower opened wide, petals covered in tiny dots. Ants? A grotesque fat hog sinking in mud with a face that looked almost human. Rob Nash? Evie was watching Arlette's face with a curious smile. Arlette turned pages numbly. Most of the drawings, she saw to her relief, were of trees, clouds, landscapes. Ordinary scenes, objects. Kevin in profile, in charcoal. Arlette seen at a distance through the doorway and in the kitchen, turned away. An anonymous female figure with a conspicuously small head. "You want to say some good will come of this? There is always some good, even in tragedy." In the past, Evie had never remained in one place long enough to accomplish much. She'd been restless, jumpy, reminding Arlette of one of those long-legged leaping spiders. Never would she have concentrated on drawing in this way. Never with such evident pleasure, immersed for long stretches, scarcely glancing up. Of course, Arlette understood, this was not a tragedy. Tragedy would be a broken neck or spine, paralysis for life, a coma, what's called a vegetative state. Of course, Arlette would have been her daughter's caretaker then, as she was now. That would have been her place, her role. That would have been the tragedy. We never knew what talent Evie had. She never knew until the accident with the bicycle. Arlette imagined a joint interview, daughter, mother, on local TV news, national news. Close-ups of Evie's drawings, portraits. Such pride in her daughter. Arlette shaking her head in awe, gratitude. Evan Hansen of Strikerville, New York. But often, as if despite her mother, Evie seemed indifferent to the drawings. Some of those that Arlette most admired, Evie tore out, crumpled.
"Oh, it's just something a million other people can do, Mom. It isn't special."
"Well, you are special."
"Am I?"
Arlette tried not to be hurt by Evie's rudeness. As others in the family were estranged from Evie and intended to avoid her, she remained close. Loyal. Often she found herself trying to entertain Evie, summoning old memories, telling stories from the past. "It was an accident how I met your father. I was 20 years old." This would have led to a fond remembrance, but Evie interrupted Arlette with an uplifted hand.
"You don't mean my father, Mom. You met a man, a stranger, and he later became my father. You didn't meet my father. That's a stupid way of speaking."
Arlette couldn't remember her daughter ever having been so pitiless in judgment of her, so unforgiving. Arlette had certainly never spoken this way to her own mother. Her mother would have slapped her. Still, Arlette recounted to Evie the story of how she and Kevin had met, not exactly on a blind date, but in a way blindly, by chance. It was a story that Arlette had told others, but did not seem so interesting now. In a TV scene, mother and daughter would bond over such tender confidences. In real life, Evie made no attempt to disguise her boredom, rapidly sketching as her mother spoke.
"So, did you win the lottery or did you lose?"
"What do you mean?"
"Did you and Dad want a daughter? If you knew who I was going to be, would you have wanted me?" "Of course, of course."
"If you went to an orphanage and there were other girls there, would you have chosen me?"
"Evie, this is unpleasant. What are you getting at? You know you are loved, and I did want a daughter, in fact."
"Did Dad?"
Yes, he did. But Arlette wasn't at all sure. And why did it matter what either of them had imagined they wanted? The family they had created was the family they had created. A female is her body. That's the problem. A man is his brain and what he can make of it. But a female is just, she is. People look at her and make a judgment in 1 second. Evie spoke flatly with finality. Arlette stood up and went, all but limping, as if she'd been wounded, to another part of the house. Each time that Rob Nash dropped by, Evie refused to see him. When the hospital bed had been returned to the rental agency and Evie was back in her old room, if she heard Rob Nash's voice, she refused to come and join the family. If he was invited to stay for dinner, she stayed in her room. Fortunately, Rob Nash ceased asking after Evie. He turned his attention to Roy and Billy, who laughed at his jokes. Carefully, Arlette said to Evie, "You don't seem to like Rob any longer, Evie. Is there any reason?" Evie laughed harshly. "You should know." "What do you mean, you should know?" "You should know. That's what I mean." "I don't know what you're talking about, Evie, really." "Really?" Evie laughed and then began coughing, walking away gracelessly, favoring her right leg. In time, Evie did return to a kind of normal. She went back to school in January, as she'd yearned to do, but during the long misery of her convalescence, something had gone wrong. Her friends had lost interest in her, or she'd lost interest in them. They were too young and silly for Evie, or, in another way, physically, Evie was too young for them, underdeveloped, a stunted creature. She'd lost the pace. She'd fallen behind, limping, cursing. Arlette was shocked to see her daughter muttering under her breath such words as the S-word, bull S-word, F-word, F-word all. Her daughter. She tried to take consolation from the fact that friends of hers with high school kids were reporting the same behavior. The boys were worse than the girls, of course, but the girls, too, were acquiring dirty mouths. In 10th grade, one of Evie's friends from middle school seemed to reappear in her life, Thalia. Arlette had not glimpsed Thalia in 2 years or more. Arlette was more thrilled than Evie when Thalia invited Evie to a sleepover birthday party. Evie shrugged. "I'll go. Okay. It's no big deal, but I'm not going to bring any damn present." "Of course you're going to bring Thalia a present," Arlette said. "We'll pick it out together at the mall." "It's okay, Mom. No big deal." "You can't show up at a birthday party without a present. You will not." At the mall, shopping for a present for Thalia, who would be 15. Nothing too fancy, but nothing too cheap either. They finally agreed on a purple suede handbag with a shoulder strap that had cost twice as much as she'd expected to pay. Evie conceded, "It's okay. It's kind of cool. Thanks, Mom." When Arlette happened to encounter Thalia's mother not long after the sleepover, she seemed not to know anything about it. Sleepover? Birthday party? At her house? Was Arlette thinking of someone else? So far as she knew, Thalia and Evie hadn't even seen each other for a long time. Arlette was stunned. She could not think of a reply. Fleeing home, stricken. "Evie lied. Lied to me. Stayed away overnight. With whom?" Realizing later, "Kevin will kill me if he finds out." It was her fault. Had to be her fault. She had failed to be vigilant. She had failed to be suspicious. She had failed to ask the right questions. She had not driven Evie to Thalia's house. Someone else had picked her up outside in the driveway. Nor had she picked Evie up the next day. Someone had brought her home. By the time that Arlette dared to confront Evie about the sleepover, it was too late. Evie did not seem surprised to be discovered, however belatedly. She claimed that she had told Arlette that the sleepover had been canceled and that she'd gone to the movie with other friends that night, girls whom Arlette didn't know, nor did Arlette know their mothers. It's no big deal, Mom. But where did you spend the night? That's what I'm asking. Evie shrugged, stalking off to her room as if she'd been insulted, exaggerating her limp. From that point onward, Arlette knew that she could not trust her daughter. How heartbreaking it was. The two had been so close during the long winter of Evie's convalescence, when Evie had been so weak, in pain, leaning desperately on Arlette as if she were a crutch. She had been a crutch, and now she's punishing me. Why is she punishing me? The convalescence had become confused in Arlette's mind with Evie's early childhood. The unspeakable intimacy of mother and infant. Arlette had been a terrified new mother, unsure of herself, unsure of her ability to keep an actual baby alive. But infants don't remain infants. Invalids don't remain invalids. Eventually, a crutch is cast aside. No one wants to recall a damn crutch. In high school, Evie's grades were erratic, unpredictable. Her enthusiasms, like her hatreds, came in surges and faded. She rarely spoke of her teachers except with derision. She had lost, it seemed, her ability to skim pages of homework, to assimilate what was essential. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll listen next week for the second part of The Bicycle Accident by Joyce Carol Oates. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.